As we all know, the field of STD prevention stands at somewhat of a critical juncture. And that's why we chose, in a lot of ways, the subtitle for the conference this year, Facing Challenges, Applying Solutions. The challenges are enormous. You guys know that. We have an enormous epidemiologic burden. We have huge health disparities. We have an infrastructure that it seems like every time we turn or every direction we turn is unraveling at a new place. We heard Chicago's Director of Public Health yesterday talk about the funding challenges they face, the challenges simply of hiring people when you have the funding, things that are all too familiar to all of you. And yet there's much to be hopeful about. There's much to be optimistic about because the opportunities, the solutions we have are broader than ever. Biomedical solutions, new tests, new vaccines, strategy advances such as approaches in partner therapy, expedited partner therapy, the use of the internet for partner notification, harmonized guidance to help us with bringing our worlds of HIV and STD partner services together. Program advances such as our increased emphasis on integrating and collaborating across programs, one of the probably the most promising developments of the field. And then finally, new strategy-specific supports, new recommendations about the better use of hepatitis B vaccines, routinized HIV testing. In the next 45 minutes or so, what I'd like to do is lay out a framework that, as the leader of the division, occurs to me as sort of an organizing way of thinking about the challenges and the solutions that we have at our disposal. I'm going to begin with some initial reflections about what I think may frame our thinking. I'd like to then move into what I think the top challenges and solutions are. And I'd like to conclude with what I've termed larger perspectives, which in and of themselves in some ways are challenges, but I think also opportunities. Reflection number one, life is all too short. Pictured here are three dear colleagues, probably not known to everybody, but colleagues who, since the last meeting in Jacksonville, have left us in the prime of their careers. Sylvie Rattel, who was with the New England Prevention and Training Center, Chris O'Leary, who was with the LA County Health Department, an anthropologist doing incredibly important work in social marketing, and Dorothy Gunter, former lead of the CDC's National Infertility Prevention Project, and currently working on the harmonized guidance. These individuals, we've lost other friends and colleagues as well, but these are particularly poignant because these folks were in the middle of incredibly promising careers. I hadn't gone back and looked at the John Donne quote, the quote from which Hemingway's novel For Whom the Bell Tolls is based, but I it really spoke to me as I thought about Sylvie, Chris, and Dorothy. That is, no man is an island, or woman, frankly, if we were to update the terminology, entire of itself. Everyone is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe, or any part of the world for that matter, is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or thine own were. Any person's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. So Sylvie, Chris, Dorothy, I dedicate the discussion of challenges and solutions we'll be having this morning to the three of you. The second reflection sort of harks back to a theme we've been using to describe the work we do for a number of years now, the hidden epidemic, the IOM report in 96, still all too much with us as an urgent reality. As stated in the executive summary, the hidden epidemic STDs are hidden epidemics of tremendous health and economic consequences. They are hidden from public view because, as Loretta Ross reminded us last night, and as Julie Gerbening told us in her own personal experiences as a medical student and a resident, Americans are reluctant to address sexual health issues in an open way, and because of the biologic and social factors associated with them. In addition, the scope, impact, and consequences of STDs are, this was in 1996, and still continue to be in 2008, under-recognized by the public and healthcare professionals. This is a current update of what we think STDs are impacting us and costing us. The 18.9 million is a little bit of a dated estimate, but almost certainly still very close to the mark. And the $15 billion in cost are almost certainly an underestimate because they're only direct cost or estimates of direct cost and probably don't include the entire burden. So these are enormously impactful public health issues at the human cost level and at the financial cost level on society. A second reflection is got to do with the paradox of STDs. And the paradox is that these hidden epidemics are on the one hand highly concentrated, and as Loretta talked to us last night, highly impactful on most vulnerable populations, and yet they are also everywhere and therefore everyone's business. And what I want to frame for you is a reminder, because this group doesn't need to be reminded about the disparities of STDs. These are the disparities over time in terms of the black-white rate ratio for the three most commonly reported diseases, syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. On the one hand, these diseases have seen progress in disparity reduction. Syphilis has declined from a 41-to-1 rate ratio in 1997 down to 7-to-1. That's a six-fold reduction, but we're still way too high. Gonorrhea has had an almost twofold reduction from 32 to 19, but 19, as Julie put it last night, is an abomination. It's a human rights issue to see these sort of disparities persist. And then finally, chlamydia, unfortunately, the trajectory of reduction has been nil. We're still dealing with the second most disparate reported disease in the country with a 9-to-1 rate ratio. Why is this? Why do we have these disparities? And I think that's sort of another theme that Loretta brought up last night. And it's becoming increasingly apparent that the social and structural factors that impact population health in general, but certainly STDs, are far more important than individual behaviors. These include a variety of phenomena in access to and utilization of healthcare, structural issues such as jobs, educational opportunities, incarceration rates, and what they do to sexual networks, which is probably a proximate cause of those unequal and highly prevalent conditions. A recent example, this just came out from a report from the Pew Center on the States in 2008, a major national black mark. The U.S. now incarcerates, we've passed the 1% mark, we now incarcerate more than 1% of the adult population, 2.3 million people. We are number one in the world, not in healthcare outcomes, but in both the number and the percent of our citizens who are incarcerated. China and Russia are the second and third, and a distant second and third. This is largely due to tough sentencing guidelines passed since the mid-1980s. This is extraordinarily costly, $50 billion a year for the states and another $5 billion for the federal government. There is a huge growth industry in corrections. Since 87, corrections spending has increased over 100%, 127%, compared to higher education spending, which has increased 21%. Five states now spend more on corrections than they do on education. What does this have to do with disparities? The obvious. We all know that disparities are disproportionately impacted by this. For men greater than the age of 18, the incarceration rate for African Americans is 1 in 15. 1 in 15. That's compared to white men, 1 in 106, and Hispanic men, 1 in 36. And yet the other part of this paradox is that as awful as these disparities are, this is not just the business of our minority populations. STDs are everyone's business, and I think one of our major tasks as we deal with our challenge and try to apply solutions is to explain and frame that everybody-ness of STD prevention. Given the high incidence of STDs and the nature of our prevention programs, STD prevention is relevant for all segments of society and not just those traditionally considered to be at high risk. I'm talking about all youth who need better awareness of STD and their prevention options. I'm talking about all preteen and adolescent females who need an HPV vaccine. I'm talking about everybody between the age of 13 and 65 who's now recommended to have an HIV test at least once. I'm talking about all sexually active women under the age of 26 who need an annual chlamydia test, and I'm talking about all sexually active MSM who need annual STD testing. Now more than ever, in short, STD is everyone's business, and a comprehensive approach to STD prevention is a shared concern among a variety of stakeholders, not just the 1,300 people in this conference, the public health workers on the front lines, but healthcare providers and generals. Parents, educators, and very, very, very critically, the American public. normalizing conversations and policies around STD prevention so that we deal with this topic as openly and normally as we would other concerns. Not that we're doing that great a job on childhood obesity, but we're at least normalizing the conversation around it. Pandemic influenza on the tip of everybody's tongue. We can talk about that in a much more open way than we can the work that we do. And we really need to get that on the mainstream table if we're going to effectively engage this very broad network of stakeholders. So with those sort of initial reflections, let me move to what I think are the top challenges and solutions facing our field now. I've lumped them somewhat arbitrarily into several disease categories: infertility prevention, syphilis elimination, vaccine-preventable STD, as well as two cross-cutting challenges and solutions: program collaboration and service integration, and our response to health disparities. Gonorrhea and chlamydia, the two top reported infectious diseases in the U.S. We just passed the million mark in 2006 with chlamydia, and all indications are that we are going to continue to see that going up. I frame this slide as a tale of two infections. We've got chlamydia that seems to be relentlessly increasing, but we all know, fortunately, that that relentless increase is actually a hallmark of good public health at work. We're doing more testing. Now, the lower left quadrant of this slide, which is a histogram of prevalence rates in family planning clinics across the 10 HHS regions of the U.S., suggests that we haven't turned the corner yet. These histograms are distressingly flat in terms of prevalence at this point in time, and that points to progress we need to make. The other infection pointed to is gonorrhea. You can't really read it, I'm sorry, from the back of the room, but these are looking at gonorrhea rates by ethnicity. The red line, the high line, the red alarm line is African-American rates. And there are two messages here. One is the disparity message I already gave you. The second is the fact that gonorrhea, although flat, remains a hyper-endemic infection, unevenly distributed, but a hyper-endemic infection in the population. The final message from this is the right lower quadrant, the ultimate outcome that we frame our prevention programs around, which is PID. Here we've got two messages. One is that the rates appear to be drifting downward, although again, are higher and more plateaued than we'd like to see. And secondly, frankly, what I'm showing you here are hospitalized data for PID, which is the best monitoring system we've got. And anybody who's been involved in STDs for the past 20 years knows that that's an increasingly smaller tip of the iceberg. And we desperately need to come up with better ways of monitoring outcomes of this really important condition. Priorities for chlamydia and gonorrhea control, as I see it, I've divided by chlamydia and gonorrhea. For chlamydia, it's screening, 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 screening. It's not all just screening, but I think screening is the major, uncapitalized upon, low-hanging fruit of our field. And therefore, organizing our efforts around enhancing screening with precious public dollars in the public sector into the potentially highest prevalence populations we can reach with those precious dollars, as well as figuring out how we do a better job with OPM, other people's money in the private sector, through enhanced promotion of guidelines, enhanced partnerships with health plans and professional organizations. Secondly, is reducing rates of reinfection. Strategies that come in here are rescreening and, very, very importantly, doing a better job with partner services. And then thirdly, not inconsequentially, but I think a distant third compared to screening of women and preventing reinfection is male screening, especially those in selected high prevalence venues. For gonorrhea, we've got different kinds of challenges. You're all aware of the fact that we pulled the plug on the use of quinolones for the treatment of gonorrhea. We have a single class of antibiotics left. The antibiotic pipeline looks like the water pipeline in Atlanta, where we have a severe drought. It's really drying up. And a major part of our strategy for gonorrhea control is going to be to try to identify cephalosporin resistance if it happens and try to corral it as soon as possible, as well as to do whatever we can to increase access to effective antibiotics. I've also alluded to a common theme here, which is trying to figure out how we strategically deal with gonorrhea as a local problem that disparately affects certain geographic and certain racial and ethnic groups. This is one of our best ways of understanding how we're doing in harvesting the low-hanging fruit of chlamydia screening. These are the trajectories of improvement we've seen with national HEDIS measures. There are four lines here. We measure annual screening of sexually active women in four different groups: commercial managed care populations and Medicaid managed care populations in two different age groups. And there's good news and bad news here. The slope of both lines is moving up. That's really good. And the glass is ever so slowly getting fuller and fuller. But the top of those lines is only around 50% or so. So the glass has got a long way to go to being filled. I'd like to remind you that the importance of reaching beyond our public sector is illustrated by this data that we're now beginning to display regularly in the CDC surveillance report. What part of the STD reported burden is coming out of non-public clinic, non-STD clinic settings? And the answer for all STDs is it's the majority. Even syphilis, the bread and butter of public STD programs, is majority-wise now being reported out of non-STD clinic settings. And for chlamydia, it's around 80 or 85%. If we're going to touch this problem, we have really got to rev ourselves up in the non-public sector. How are we going to do that? I think one of the most promising ways we'll do that is through partnerships. This is not the be-all, end-all, not the silver bullet, but it's a recent example that really is giving us a lot of promise. We've been working at CDC with a group called the Partnership for Prevention. This is largely a group that does cost-effectiveness analyses. They recently published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine their top preventive services that had the lowest utilization rates. So this is, again, the lowest hanging fruit, what's most cost effective that we're least well utilizing. And number four on that list was screening sexually active women under the age of 25 for chlamydia, which at the time they put this together was estimated to be only 40%. We're currently working with the Partnership for Prevention to do several things. First of all, to put together a chlamydia screening implementation guide, not for public programs, because you guys get it, but to try to better promote this strategy in the private sector. Secondly, we've recently established a proto-embryonic, because it really hasn't come into being yet, National Coalition for Chlamydia Screening. There are eight founding organizations, including ASH on CDC, on the steering committee of this. There are discussions with additional organizations going on, and there will be a launch meeting in May to try to pull together a larger number of groups. Committees have been formed to deal with public awareness, provider education, health services research, and advocacy. One of the models we've looked to, we always seem to be looking to the West Coast. Gail Boland gave a great presentation at CDC last week about the California Chlamydia Coalition and what's happened there. They prepared an action plan in 1999 to try to do exactly what we're trying to do nationally, which is to partner with a whole breadth of stakeholders in this game. And what you see in the first two histograms is the national managed care HEDIS rates and the national Medicaid managed care HEDIS rates of screening. And those, as you just saw, maybe get up to around 50%. In contrast, what I'd like you to focus on is the right part of the slide, the histogram of screening in California. They're not perfect, but in Family Pact, the Family Planning Action Group in California, their screening rates are now up to 70%. I think it's a direct result of this kind of broad networking and partnership, which I think is really a major mantra for us as we look down the road to the future. The other thing I'd like to really emphasize as a work in progress and a changing landscape, but one that I think continues to have extraordinary promise, as a primary strategy in preventing reinfection is better partner services strategies. This is a legal landscape of where expedited partner therapy is permissible, questionably permissible, and probably not permissible. I've added some colors. I like to show this slide a lot because it helps me sort of get it from the U.S. perspective as to what's happening. There's some new colors here. Four states, including the state we're sitting in right now, where legislation is under discussion to make expedited partner therapy legal. In fact, I was just told yesterday that Iowa has now become a blue state as well, and there's legislation pending there. Now, we're not home free, because even in places like California, which has got the longest track record of using this, there's lots of progress to be made. But I think this is a great low technology thing for our field to focus on, and it's within the grasp of everybody who's in a leadership position within a local or a state municipality to be aware of this and to try to push it. Gonorrhea. I've already alluded to the challenges we face with the loss of the fluoroquinolones. This was the MMWR that came out last April announcing that. The surveillance symposium tomorrow will outline, in part, increasing GISP data that says this was the right decision. Fluoroquinolones are not going to be coming back to be useful. We are left with only cephalosporins as a class of antibiotics. Unfortunately, there was another piece of bad news on the horizon last year. This was a report in the MMWR about gonorrhea changing maybe from its monotonous flatness Eight Western states reported a 42% increase in gonorrhea from the time period 2000 to 2005. Now, a lot of this was undoubtedly increased testing, but when the investigators looked really hard to try to explain and determine whether or not it was all that, the answer was probably not. The increases were seen not just in MSM, not just in women, but across all genders and all racial and ethnic groups. Explanations are unclear. Speculations: could this be inappropriate treatment because of quinolone resistance? Maybe, probably not. Have to entertain that as a possibility. Could this be related to increased methamphetamine use, fueling gonorrhea transmission just like syphilis? Not clear, possibly. Need to stay tuned on that one. Our second sort of priority area of challenge and solution is syphilis elimination. As you're all aware, we relaunched the national plan to eliminate syphilis 2 years ago. This was largely in response to the fact that the initial progress we made had stalled out and in fact been reversed because of the epidemic that all of you are all too aware of in men who have sex with men. And our challenge remains the same. It's maintaining momentum in the originally targeted populations where we have been doing reasonably well, but there are cracks in the edifice. Outbreaks in Birmingham, outbreaks in Memphis, outbreaks on Native American reservations in the Southwest tell us that all is not completely well, as well as trying to determine new tools to respond to the epidemic in MSM. These are data that Hillard Weinstock will be presenting tomorrow in the surveillance symposium. The red line of men has continued to go up. That dotted yellow line, the male-female rate ratio, which has historically been our best way of appraising what proportion of the syphilis burden is in MSM, continues to suggest that it's probably around 60% or so of the national burden. And therefore, our priorities for syphilis elimination include continuing to enhance public and provider awareness. Syphilis is, let me remind you, still at historically almost lowest ever levels. This is still a relatively rare disease. And there are far too many of our provider colleagues and the general public who are simply unaware that syphilis is back. It's figuring out how we take advantage of new strategies such as the internet-based prevention programs, the integrated guidance to enhance efficiency of our partner services, as well as the ongoing use of local data to tailor program efforts. And I'd have to say that CDC has probably been a contributor to the lack of versatility at the local level. We had a really interesting meeting on Sunday looking at the question of program science. How do we as researchers, how do we as program people connect the dots more effectively? And one of the messages that came out most loudly was empowering state and local programs to be able to use their data and use their innovation most effectively. I think that really is a challenge in general, and it's certainly a challenge for syphilis elimination. And yet doing this and not forgetting that if we turn our attention too far away from the original populations, syphilis is almost certainly likely to emerge there. There'll be a symposium or a workshop later this week on what I think is a really exciting development in the area of potential syphilis control, and that's internet-related prevention activities. Our co-sponsoring organization, NCSD, has recently issued guidance on internet-based prevention activities. Modules on partner services and outreach are now available. This is a compilation of best practices among groups that have been doing these sort of internet activities for now 5 or 6 years. It's a great pulling together of information that should serve both as a repository of advice as well as a stimulus for those not yet involved in this area. There's a module on health communication that is available in draft form and will be completed within the next several months. Rachel Kosher in our division has been really active in this area and recently helped me pull together some, this is numerator stuff, okay? These are anecdotes, but some information about the kinds of stuff that's happening. For example, manhunt.com, which has been a highly visible sex-seeking site and yet one that has really worked very effectively with public health. There are now outreach activities on manhunt.com with 157 organizations in 37 states. Partner services through the internet are being done in 14 states and 4 cities. Another approach to e-partner services, InSpot, which allows individuals to send email contacts to exposed partners. 8 cities, including Chicago, have got InSpot programs in 8 states. This conference is beginning to allow us to understand some of the effect of that. There are presentations here about internet partner notification in Chicago, where 40% of sex partners now evaluated were identified through the internet. Another report out of Washington, 68% of sex partners with no other locating information were able to be informed through the internet. Matt Hogman in our division, who's really been very active with Rachel working in this area, has got an editorial in press from STD, and I wanted to quote from it, that really where we're at with the state of this art is that almost every health department ought to be receptive to and actively trying to find ways to use the internet, because this is not going to replace other methods, but it's very likely to reach partners who are going to remain otherwise ignorant of their exposure to STD and HIV. So not an expensive, but an impressive and an important new technologic development. And finally, I would be remiss in talking about syphilis if I didn't remind all of us that this isn't all about rashes and lesions and enhanced HIV transmission. Syphilis can damage permanently. This was reported in the MMWR last summer that collated in a meaningful way what the likely impact of neurosyphilis on HIV-infected MSM. This came from a medical record review in four cities. The investigators concluded that 1.7% of MSM with syphilis developed early symptomatic neurosyphilis. This is not rashes, this is not lesions, this is neurologic damage. And that a third of these individuals for whom there was follow-up information had permanent sequelae, visual impairment, motor impairment, lost hearing. Social marketing work tells us that both HIV-infected as well as HIV-negative MSM consider syphilis to be a relatively minor background piece of noise until you begin to talk about things like enhanced HIV transmission, elevated viral load, and permanent neurologic sequelae. So an important message for all of us to keep in mind. Let me switch now to another promising area, promising because it provides what in from a public health individual intervention perspective has always been the gold standard, a vaccine. It's a metaphor that everybody gets incredibly excited about because of the success with vaccines in smallpox and polio. And we now have the opportunity to play with this metaphor in our field. The HPV vaccine, which is a clearly not yet at all completely realized intervention, has got a number of innovations coming in 08 that I want to alert you to. Vaccine licensure for women over the age of 26, which is being framed, interestingly enough, in discussions by ACIP as older women, most women sort of take issue with that designation, is under consideration. The efficacy is coming in. It looks like it's going to be as high as it is in younger women. The problem is, however, what's the cost effectiveness going to be? We know that the incidence of HPV infection in these, quote, older women is likely to be a lot lower. Therefore, not at all clear what recommendations ought to be made. A second issue is that I think is going to be even more interesting is the licensure of a second vaccine. We have a quadrivalent, four-type vaccine, two genital warts types, two cancer types. The new bivalent vaccine, which is likely to be licensed in the latter part of this year, is going to raise a number of issues. Should a preference be stated for one vaccine versus another? That's going to be a really important issue. Is there enough cross protection? Then one can switch back and forth if one's not sure what one's patient has received. Is there any preferential cross protection or any preferential duration of immunity? Don't know those answers yet. May determine those recommendations over time. And then finally, the other part of the equation, males. There are studies going on in men. These studies are likely to come to fruition within the next year and a half. A lot of questions about what recommendations ought to be made, and from my perspective, really a lot of very interesting questions about how the vaccine will be marketed and framed. Very interesting presentation at the conference, I think it's tomorrow, by Melissa Hobble, content analysis of HPV vaccine in online news stories. 250 articles reviewed in 2006 after the vaccine was licensed. And I want to sort of share with you this framing information because I think it's really challenging for us as we think about the everybody's business part of STD prevention. Mostly this is framed as a cervical cancer vaccine, to a lesser extent an HPV vaccine, although most of the time the HPV vaccine framing wasn't directly linked to sexual transmission. The STI frame was used in a minority of cases. And again, among those who use the HPV frame, only a minority actually refer to it as a sexually transmitted vaccine. Now, we all know the media has got enormous potential to frame messages, and there have been a couple of recent examples that I thought were worth sharing. You may have seen the article in the New York Times about a month ago, Vaccinating Boys for Girls' Sake, a new front in the fight against cervical cancer. It's kind of a clever, funny thing. How cool are those Gardasil girls riding horses, flinging softballs, bashing away on drum sets, et cetera, et cetera. You've all seen the marketing campaigns. But somebody's missing from this girl power tableau. Ah, that's Gardasil boy. Gardasil's girls, cancer-related virus, sexually transmitted. She almost certainly got it from him. And so, as we all know, the pitch of Gardasil now is to parents about protecting their children from cancer. What about the parents of sons? How are they going to buy this? How do you pitch that, as the article put it, to Gardasil's boys' parents? Think altruism, responsibility, chivalry even, oh yeah, and maybe some explicit details about genital warts and sexual transmission. The other angle that may be raising that everybody's business thing is the attention on oral cancer. There have been a couple of publications recently that have pointed out, just number one, how tightly linked HPV of the genital types is to oropharyngeal cancers and how some of these cancers may be increasing. Bernadine Healy, former director of NIH, is now a science analyst for U.S. News and World Report, had this article or this perspective piece in that magazine about a week ago. And pointing again that given the concern about oropharyngeal cancer, this will also bear on the use of the HPV vaccine, currently approved only for young women. But when it comes to HPV-related oropharyngeal cancer, men are actually greater at risk than women. This should provide strong impetus for an HPV vaccine that works for men too. So we're seeing this drumbeat of potential interest in men. And the question I have for our field, and I don't think one we have consensus about, is what role do we have and how would we actually like to see this currently framed as a cancer vaccine ultimately framed? The pros of framing it as an STD vaccine are sort of intuitively obvious to lots of us. It's number one, honesty. It's clarity about what's actually being prevented. Secondly, if male recommendations come to pass, it's going to have to be framed in that way. And then finally, from my perspective, maybe most importantly, is its potential for sort of further normalizing conversations about STD prevention. This is not now only every young female's business. It could be everybody's business. However, it's not been marketed in this way for obvious reasons. There's a fear that if it is so marketed, that parents, the public, and providers will be more reluctant to use the vaccine. And so we've got this sort of tension in the air as to whether or not we can make this do good things or whether we may, in fact, do harm if we were to, in fact, have such a framing. I want to allude to an old vaccine and some new promises and new opportunities, and it's Hep B immunization of adults. As you all know, the vaccine's been around since before most of us started in the field. King, maybe not you, but most of us. And we've incompletely vaccinated the population. We've done a great job with children and adolescents. As those people grow up, they're being protected. Rates are falling in the population, but we've got a missed generation of adults. New recommendations came out in 06 reminding us of this and recommending that we vaccinate individuals in venues where individuals at risk for STDs were seen, such as STD clinics. That was a reasonably empty recommendation without any bucks to back it up. The bucks to back it up came to pass this past year with an adult Hep B immunization initiative where an additional $20 million in 317 money has been made available. 51 project areas were funded as of last October for vaccination in a variety of settings, including STD clinics. I think this is really sort of a major step forward in the ability of finally implementing what should have been a long ago executed promising possibility. I didn't really list other STD as challenges, but I put it in here and actually connects with the breakfast session that happened this morning on herpes, because what I've talked about so far are the STDs for which we have organized prevention programs. And yet, the other STDs, such as trichomoniasis and herpes simplex, which comprise almost half of the 19 million burden in the U.S., are ones for which we don't have organized prevention programs. What should we do about that? How should we focus on those, and do we run the risk, if we do, of losing focus and emphasis on our other priorities? This was an article that showed up in the Journal of Infectious Diseases last fall by Scott McClellan at the University of Washington, Trichomonas vaginalis infection, can we afford to do nothing? And you can't read it from back there. I really want you to just focus on the headlines, but Scott's basically challenging us. Look, trich has a number of sequelae. It's curable. It's eminently diagnosable. What's it going to take for us to organize formal activities to try to prevent it? Ned Hook and Peter Leone co-published a similar sounding piece about a year and a half ago on genital herpes, Time to Translate New Knowledge into Practice, a call for a national genital herpes program. We have serologic testing. We have suppressive antiviral therapy. What ought we to be doing about that? In some ways, herpes prevention, because we know that it's been probably the most important sexually transmitted disease from an HIV enhancement point of view, is at a crossroads. There is a growing body of data linking HSV2 to HIV. HIV acquisition is increased by at least 2 to 4-fold by having herpes infection. HIV transmission is probably increased. We know that herpes increases plasma and genital viral load, and that suppressive antiviral therapy can drop both these things. We've got clinical trials underway, and we had a disappointment last month that'll be discussed at a symposium tomorrow with the large prevention trial for HIV acquisition using suppressive acyclovir having not been successful. This was an extraordinarily well-performed study with extraordinarily high levels of compliance, and the dosages used, acyclovir 400 milligrams twice a day, didn't work full stop. Now, nobody knows exactly why that is, but you can't ask for a more definitive trial, at least with that current medication doses looking. There are other trials pending for what many think may be the more promising opportunity of preventing transmission. The Partners in Prevention trial that Dr. Kellum, who was the PI of HPTN-039, should be available sometime in the next 1 to 2 years and may provide some opportunities for us. But what should we as a field do in the meantime? And I ask myself this question as director of the STD Prevention Division all the time. What are our opportunities right now with our diminishing resources for herpes? Well, I think it's pretty clear we need to look for opportunities to increase awareness, whether we have antiviral suppressive interventions that work or not, about the risk of herpes and enhancing HIV transmission. I don't think we've gotten that message out there sufficiently well. And the message for those who have herpes is get HIV tested and use risk reduction, because you're at increased risk for HIV, especially if you're in a community with disparities for HIV and herpes, such as the African American community. We need to enhance diagnosis of those with symptomatic infection, encourage strategies that are likely to prevent transmission, such as the use of condoms and selective suppressive therapy, and develop strategies to assess the burden of and prevent neonatal herpes infection, something that is still all too important, a problem that has not been adequately addressed. Our field is nothing if not new and challenging. I'm not here to stand up today and claim MRSA as a sexually transmitted infection. In fact, I want to do the opposite and say this is not an STD. And the article that came out in the Annals of Internal Medicine with all the accompanying publicity suggesting that gay men were harboring another killer STI is the wrong message. But I do want to note the observation that the skin-to-skin contact that occurs with sex with anybody, has got the potential for transmitting MRSA. And this is sort of another piece on the landscape of the issues of, quote, other conditions associated with sex that we, our field is dealing with. I want to say a few words about what I've termed here cross-cutting challenges and solutions, specifically program collaboration and service integration, and responding to health disparities. Those of you who will be here for the rest of the week will have the opportunity of hearing our center director, Kevin Fenton, talk about his perspectives on what we are terming PICSI. It makes it sound sort of trivial, but it's not. It's a polysyllabic mouthful of representing an incredibly important concept. And in our field, we've been doing PICSI for a long time, but it's incredibly empowering to have an organized public health approach to try to look for best opportunities and methodologies for doing this. The possibilities for us are enormous. I've already alluded to the viral hepatitis prevention collaboration opportunities. You all know about the new HIV testing initiative and how STD clinics remain a major focus of collaborative work in that area. You're also painfully aware of the fact that our STD screening recommendations for people that are HIV infected and in care are not being adequately carried out. There are data at the conference about just how far short we're falling of that, an incredibly important opportunity for collaboration, not just with HIV prevention, but also HIV care. HPV vaccine points to the obvious need for collaboration with immunization and cancer prevention partners. We have longstanding partnerships that need to be robustly continued with our partners in reproductive health, STD testing among women seeking contraceptive care, as well as in family planning, as well as in STD clinics. And then finally, we've got these cross-cutting public health activities, partner services, surveillance and data systems, guidance and training, monitoring and evaluation, that I think in some ways may present the most fertile fields for collaboration. And one upcoming example of that are the newly revised, finally long-awaited, it seems like it's been forever, harmonized STD-HIV partner services guidelines. This will be discussed at a symposium in this meeting and released, we hope, Matt, maybe in June. I've cleared it now, so hopefully that'll happen. As you all know, there's been a culture war, maybe too strong a word, but certainly philosophic differences between HIV and STD prevention programs in terms of partner services. The intent of these harmonized efforts is to try to bring things together. We successfully were able to create a harmonized interview record form that seems pretty trivial, but it took forever to work for both HIV and STD partner notification. This will, for the first time in ages, allow us to capture information about gender of partner, HIV co-infection status for individuals with STD, venues of meeting partners such as the internet, so critical, as well as drug use, methamphetamines, providing both better data for local decision making as well as better data for us to craft national policy. The integrated program guidance is going to update the 1998 HIV PCRS guidance as well as the 2000 STD program operation guidelines, and will be highly supportive of the new HIV testing recommendations that strongly enhances and supports partner services. I must have mentioned the word disparities about eight times now, but I want to talk to you a little bit about some progress, some really promising progress that we've made in the last year. We had what I think was really a seminal consultation in June framed around STD disparities in African American communities. A number of extraordinarily important observations came out of the consultation, ones that I've already mentioned, that multiple factors contribute to STD disparities in these communities, including social determinants outside of the traditional public health paradigm, that to address disparities, we absolutely have to have involvement and engagement of the affected communities because of the highly explosive intersection, stigmatizing intersection of STD and race. Messages have got to be framed and communicated appropriately to minimize stigma, and approaches have got to be crafted that are not just acceptable to, but owned by, as Loretta talked to us last night, communities. The integration of these strategies with HIV is essential. This is a pixie opportunity to maximize impact, and as I quote from one of the speakers at the conference, people have got to look into what can be done to break down the silos between these overlapping epidemics. We haven't resolved disparities, but I'm highly encouraged by actions that have taken place since the consultation. Our meeting report that was shown on the previous slide is now available on our website. Meeting background papers are being collated and will be published soon. We've set up some internal structures, a work group. We'll be hiring soon a new disparities coordinator. We have a new disparities strategic plan that has been crafted in draft form and has been shared with, or is being shared now with, external partners from the consultation. The consultation resulted in a group of subcommittees working together, including CDC and external individuals, looking at a variety of different areas. And then finally, we've begun to actualize some of this sort of collaborative opportunity. We've had collaborative efforts with the HIV division's heightened national response to HIV/AIDS in African Americans. STD, HIV, hepatitis, TB disparities were strongly highlighted in the Center's disparity report that was released in November. And we've got formative research underway trying to ask what is often a conundrum of a question, which is, can you effectively mix STD and HIV messages for communities and not create message clutter, not let them get in the way of each other? I want to close with a couple of comments about what I've termed larger perspectives. One larger perspective is infrastructure. Okay, so bridges falling down isn't our job, but bridges falling down is a major metaphor and wake-up call that infrastructure, as Susan Delisle put it the other day, is really boring until it doesn't work, and then it's really critical, as the bridge failure in Minneapolis reminded us of what we've neglected for so long. These are data that are, not data, but budgetary estimates I showed you 2 years ago. The urgent realities of TB and STD prevention have been allowed to languish. The real buying power of our federal investment declining 15% from 01 to 06, which is almost certainly with inflation and rescissions that we've experienced over the last 2 years, higher than that now, calculated to be somewhere around 19 to 20%. This is a just-out report from the American Schools of Public Health, a statement on the public health workforce, and I really want to bring it to your attention if you hadn't seen it. One of our frontline colleagues, Jim Lee, shared this with us the other day. ASPH looked at the ratio of public health workers to the population in 1980, which was hardly the golden age of public health, but as you look at what's happened in 2000, it's more golden than where we've been recently. We had 220 public health workers per 100,000 population in 80. That had shrunk by 20% to 158 per 100,000. ASPH calculated with the increasing population by 2020, when we might have 335 millions of us in this country, to meet the 1980 rate, not necessarily the gold standard, but a historical frame of reference, we were going to need another 250,000, 220,000 public health workers. And even to get to the level in 2000, we were going to need another 86,000. That challenge doesn't take into consideration the fact that many of us will almost certainly be retired by 2012. 23% is what ASPH recommended, or rather calculated. There are shortages in almost all areas of public health: docs, nurses, administrators, epidemiologists, healthcare educators. So a looming issue, a looming crisis that I don't stand up here today and give you solutions for, but I point to as something that we're all aware of, and I think ASPH has recently reframed it for us. So what can we do to respond to these challenges? I mean, there are some modest workforce development efforts underway. We heard yesterday from Dr. Gerbeding in the field staff meeting about the CDC apprenticeship program in Florida. It'll be expanded to Texas. There's a lot of interest in trying to expand this much more broadly to build up at least our federal field worker, frontline worker capacity. We've got an effort underway right now to try to develop a pilot STD program manager training module, to try to give program managers the kind of tools to make local decisions. I've alluded to partnerships. I've alluded to collaboration and service integration. We all know, I'm not going to do advocacy up there this morning, that education of policymakers is a critical underlying element of all of this. And then we also know that program innovations, which has been sort of a hallmark of our field, will remain a hallmark. And I want to point to a couple of, on my numerator-driven review of the proceedings, some of the most promising innovations that popped out at me. The development of something as simple as what are called express visits in core clinics, STD clinics, where rather than everybody getting a gold standard physical examination by a doc, those that are asymptomatic who are not known contacts of STDs are allowed to move through a faster process. Urine testing for chlamydia and gonorrhea, blood testing for syphilis, either oral or blood testing for HIV. Denver, New York, Chicago have all reported substantial allocations of, or rather diversions of their clinic flow toward these more efficient visits. New York reported that they were able to detect 28% more gonorrhea and chlamydia during the time frame that they had introduced this, with no decline in the number treated. Really interesting, not a population-based innovation, but certainly one that affects core services. The use of home testing. We've known that vaginal swabs can perform as well as cervical and urine-based collection methodologies for chlamydia detection. Fuji Zhu and colleagues report on a study looking at self-collected vaginal swabs, which performed equally effectively to return to clinic rates in terms of getting women rescreened. Now, 30 and 23% are not great. Don't let me overemphasize that, but the point was you can do as well with what is more convenient and more efficient as you can with getting people to come back. A novel approach of providing cost feedback to try to enhance compliance with guidelines. Region 10 Infertility Prevention Project found that they had a substantial number of outliers, women who were being screened with public dollars, not according to criteria. When they began to provide direct feedback to programs, guess what? The noncompliance rate dropped in half. And when they further began to bill programs for screening individuals who didn't fall within criteria, the numbers fell even further. So these are small, modest tweaks that have the potential, sort of in a continuing quality improvement kind of framework, for improving services. The last few minutes, I want to get back to what is in the air everywhere now, and that is our healthcare system. This was a New Yorker cartoon that I thought put a particularly STD-appropriate spin on this. Jimmy and Jane play doctor. I think we're in Jimmy's room. There's a pennant and a boombox, and it's kind of messy. What sort of insurance do you have? And Jane, well, actually, I don't have any. Well, goodbye then. So it's getting down to the Jimmy and Jane level of what people appreciate. This is a way I've liked to put together the impact of lack of insurance. I showed something like this 2 years ago. There are 47 million of us uninsured right now. 18% of the non-elderly population. This is an increasing problem, growing about 8-9% since the mid-1990s. We know that lack of insurance corresponds to the people who get STDs, age, ethnicity, family income. We also have increasing data that if you don't have insurance, you don't do so well. You're less likely to receive preventive care. You're less likely to fill prescription drugs. The IOMS estimated that we may be encountering something like 22,000 excess deaths nationally and lost economic value in the range of $65 to $130 billion with a B dollars. This is a major, major issue. These are data out of Health U.S., which is an annual snapshot view of health status in the U.S. Released every year. What I'm pointing to here is the impact on not having insurance on a couple of parameters: not getting medical care due to cost, delayed medical care due to cost, not getting prescription drugs. And I want to highlight two things. Number one, if you're in a minority group, you don't do as well as white people. Okay? That's been known, but here we've got national data that tell us this quite clearly. Secondly, I'd like to point to you that not everybody is permanently uninsured. And since most of our insurance is employment-based, and since the economy hasn't been in great shape and is probably going to be getting worse, we have variability. And individuals who are uninsured for any period of time, not just chronically uninsured, do almost as badly as the people that are chronically uninsured. So that 47 million is a snapshot at a single point in time and doesn't include other individuals who have been partially uninsured through the year. This is a question that I found so provocative when Julie framed it, and I used this in her introduction yesterday. Why isn't the U.S., the country that spends the most on health, the healthiest nation? There's a couple of points in the slide. Number one, we spend a lot of money. The U.S. leads in per capita spending as well as the percent of GDP. There's only one other country in the world that's in double figures, Switzerland. Everybody else, Canada, the U.K., is in single digits. The access to care issue is continues to be difficult in the country. The quality of care is spotty. We have overutilization, we have underutilization, and we have medical errors. And then finally, as Julie has really been so, I think, visionary in pushing, we have a failure to invest in protecting health. This is a particularly thought-provoking piece that was in the New England Journal last fall, a Shattuck lecture by Steve Schroeder, where the title of it, we Can Do Better, Improving the Health of the American People. And there were two illustrations in particular I thought were important. One is the table here, which shows that the U.S. ranks poorly among the 30 largest developed countries in the world in various health outcomes. This includes infant mortality, maternal mortality, life expectancy from birth, as well as life expectancy once you hit 65. And whether you look at all races in the U.S. or whether you look just at white people to try to get around the issue that we know that minority communities have worse health outcomes, the U.S. doesn't look very good. 22 for white people in infant mortality, 19 for white people in maternal mortality, 19 for white men in life expectancy since birth. Now, I'm not emphasizing whites because that's the group we care about, au contraire, but even when one looks at that should be healthiest, we don't do so well. The other thing that's really, really important to point out is a tabulation of a proportionate contribution to premature mortality that was taken by Schroeder from an article by McGinnis. And healthcare, which is really important, as the IOM report pointed out, probably only accounts for around 10% of premature death, with the rest of it basically being due to things that are individually behaviorally, genetically, or socially and structurally determined, with behavioral patterns accounting for 40%, genetic predisposition 30%, social circumstances 15%, and environmental exposure 5%. So even in this analysis, if we fix the healthcare system, if we give everybody access to the most expensive healthcare on earth, we'll only be correcting the problem by about 10% or so. So I'm quoting now quite liberally. I told Julie I like pirating her slides on this, and she said, fine, go for it, so I will, about transforming the U.S. healthcare system. Our current system provides excellent care, but it's lacking in equity, access, and it's lacking in health protection. We emphasize health protection within public health, in parts through our connection with the healthcare system, but our capacity, as we all know, is undervalued and under-resourced. We don't measure or report our results very well, frankly, even in STD prevention. And our consumers, and this is really critical, don't understand public health value. The upshot is that our population health outcomes aren't so good, especially given the investment we put into it. And to quote Julie, in this election season, which we, even government employees, can talk about, because we are going to have a change in government of one kind or another, the time is now, because we're at this very important political position in terms of the upcoming elections. And the fact is, this is going to be a very important part of any debate, either during the election or certainly in the next administration. And if we don't get our act together is public health, and come to the table to contribute, we will once again miss our opportunity to, for public health to really make a contribution to help. And to illustrate that this is in the land, this is sort of out there alive and well, this is an NPR, Kaiser Family Foundation, Harvard School of Public Health poll that was released, discussed on NPR about 2 weeks ago. Number of in the U.S. who believe that the uninsured is a serious problem. This is not the whole story. This is insurance again. But it's 74% think it's either very serious, 74% think very, and 93% very or somewhat. And this is bipartisan. The next bar there is Democrats, who are more concerned. But even the Republicans believe 51% that it's very and 35% someone, with independents being somewhere in between those two. Final reflections. I want to quote again from a piece that I found particularly inspirational. Larry Wallach, who's the Dean of Urban and Social Affairs at Portland State University in Oregon, was a speaker at our conference in 1996 when the Hidden Epidemic came out, and Larry talked to us a lot about framing messages. In a piece that he wrote last summer, Larry told us that there are indicators that the urgency of huge problems such as global warming and health care is causing a shift to begin. The shift will be away from individuals just working on their own to overcome obstacles, to opportunity, to groups working collectively to expand opportunity for all. It'll be moving away from an ethic of people just working to beat the odds to developing social policies that reduce the odds, level the playing field, and apply rules that are fairer so that more can take advantage of opportunity. He goes on that there's an old adage that if you can tell a nation's stories, you don't have to worry about who makes the laws. We need more stories that articulate the values of shared responsibility, obligation of the local and global community, civic participation, and an appropriate helping hand role for government. We need to bring these values to life by connecting them to social policy approaches that can increase the cost for success, the odds for success, rather than stack the odds for failure. We can create stories that activate the traditional American values of pulling together, not just the values of rugged individualism. So tell a story that taps a deep truth about your community, about the people in it, and about the country we live in and we hope to live in. Tell a story that reflects our collective aspirations and reinforces the core value that we really are all in this together. So I want to close by trying to bring Larry's perspective back home to our field, and I want to do so in a way that I really think would call upon the legacy that Sylvie and Chris and Dorothy left us. With the enormous contributions they made. I think they'd really agree with us that we really are all in this together. STD prevention is not only everyone's business, that it's a shared responsibility for all of us to encourage society to be sure to slightly modify a phrase. There is no adolescent or adult left behind. And that we ought to all be involved in working with all of our stakeholders to endorse the entire alphabet of prevention, the role of abstinence in appropriate circumstances, that for those who choose to be sexually active, being faithful, avoiding concurrent partnerships, the C's of using condoms and contraception, the D's of receiving appropriate diagnostics, including screening, the E's of education, and as Loretta put it yesterday, empowerment, and then the promising hope on the horizon, all the way down to V's of vaccines. I want to quickly acknowledge the many, many people who shared material with me, inspired me. They were extraordinarily generous. I hope that these remarks will help frame your appreciation of what I know promises to be the most exciting STD prevention conference we've ever had. Thank you very much.